Okay, we're in 1 Thessalonians, the book of 1 Thessalonians. We're in chapter 4, and we've gone through about the first 7 or 8 verses, 9 verses actually, I think. So we're moving into this next section, and I think I said this, where's my note on that? This chapter sort of runs into chapter 5, the beginning of chapter 5. You could break this chapter up in this following way. Let's see, there's page 2. 1 and 2. Okay. You could break this chapter up into verses 1 through 8, which deals with issues of purity, sexual purity, moral purity, and then verses 9 through 12, issues of social conduct, how should we conduct our lives. Then the last part of this is verses 13 through 18, questions about the dead or questions about the second coming or what will happen in the second coming or about those who've died before Jesus comes back. And that gets into this big end time discussion. So let's pick it up at verses 9 or through 12, and we'll take that next section, I think. Let me just find my note here. Okay, that's it. Issues of social conduct. For 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 9 through 12. Now, as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. For indeed, you do practice it toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more and to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business, and work with your own hands, just as we commanded you, so that you will behave properly toward outsiders and not be in any need. Okay? And so this section, we talked a little bit about verse 9, I think, last week. Notice what he focuses on first in this first section, or who does he focus on? If we ask the who question, who does he talk about in this first verse? Who are the who's in verse 9? Okay, right. And he's coming back to something, isn't he? Something he's said before. So let me get my pages up here. He's sort of said this before. and this is kind of a common theme that runs throughout a lot of what Paul's written. In Romans, he says, chapter 12, verse 10, be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor. And, of course, the phrase that he uses here is this word Philadelphia, which is, you know, the name of one of our cities, of course, and that means, you know, the love of the brothers or the love of one's brother. And you contrast that to the idea of what has he just been talking about in verses 1 through 8. We talked about that a little bit. Do you recall what we talked about? What was he warning them about, or what, you know? Yeah. So rather than any kind of promiscuity or adultery or impurity, in fact, the last thing he says, verse 6, one of the last things he says, don't let anyone transgress or defraud his brother in this matter, you know, and speaking about the cases of addressing the issues of adultery. So in contrast to that, the love of the brethren, you know, of the positive love of the brethren. Not like not doing the other thing, but doing this other thing. Not like the world does things. You know, and we see this as a place where people are defrauded all the time. This, again, is a theme that I think we asked last time about how is this manifested or revealed in the church? Now, as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you. You yourselves are taught by God to love one another. What's one of the things that we should see in a Christian church? What's one of the manifestations of this kind of love? Okay, so how would you manifest that care? What would be some way that you manifest that care? Do we just have a demonstration of that tonight, what we were doing? You know, we're lifting up other people's concerns, you know. First, we're aware of their concerns. That's why we ask, are there any needs? And then we pray. Because we believe that if we pray, God will help. God will help in that situation, you know. So one of the ways we express the love for the brethren is through our prayers. Is that the only way? When you're doing that thing, you're demonstrating that this is an activity that has a value, it has a priority, because you're spending time on it, you're pouring efforts into it. Is this a benefit to us directly? You know, it's kind of focused on a particular group of people, isn't it? You know, kids don't generally give stuff back to you, at least not when they're that age, you know, but you make that investment in them, and that's another way of showing the love of the brethren. What's one of the last things that Jesus taught his disciples? In fact, the night before he died. Remember John chapter 13? At the Last Supper? I got mine in the book of Acts. That's why that looks funny. And that was a demonstration or a very practical example of an expression of when you're washing somebody else's feet. Why? Because you don't want their stinky feet in your meeting? No. But it's an expression of what? Yeah. Humility and love, isn't it? One of the last things Jesus says to his disciples is, a new commandment I give to you. It's not really new, but new to them, that you love one another even as I have loved you. This is John 13:34 and 35. That you also love one another. By this all men will know. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And what should characterize the church, beyond anything else, is a mutual concern for one another. What happens to you affects me. What happens to me affects you. And if I'm not aware of that, then I don't really understand what the church is all about. It's kind of one of those foundational truths. And he's writing to these Thessalonians. He says something about this loving one another. Notice what he says. Who is the one who teaches this to them? That's kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, didn't we think Paul was the one who was teaching here? But what does Paul say? He says, God is teaching this to you. God is instructing you about this. Does God instruct us? Have you ever been instructed by God? Okay, you could say, yeah, through your pastors, through your teachers. That'd be one way, you know. Right. What are some other ways that God is instructing us? about this principle of loving one another. Well, yeah, but we're talking about instruction. Instruction usually means the transmission of an idea or a principle from one mind to another mind. That's basically what instruction is. So how is God transmitting his idea that we should love one another to us? It's one of the ways he does it. Yeah. What did Jesus do by his example? What did he show us by his example? So that same kind of example appears in the church, doesn't it? You have people you see serve other people, you know, out of love. And then that becomes an example to, number one, it's a way of God instructing us through other people, but it's an example to us to follow, to emulate, to model ourselves after. Are these the only way that God instructs us or teaches us? Okay, yeah. Well, that's usually when you get off the track, you know. You remember what he says about the Holy Spirit? That he will lead you into all truth. When he comes, he will take a mind, he'll reveal it to you. I'm going to send you another helper. You know, it's to your advantage I go away, but I'll send another helper. I will ask the Father, John 14:16, I'll ask the Father to give you another helper that he may be with you forever. This is the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive because it does not see him nor know him, but you know him, for he abides in you and he abides with you and will be in you. I won't leave you as orphans. You know. And he basically is saying here that the Spirit of God is going to be continually instructing us, working in us, leading us into all truth. So there's that whole thing of day by day. Have you had the experience where you're going through a day and all of a sudden you start to think about somebody's laid on your heart. It feels like God is reminding you about somebody. You know, they have a need or they have a situation. That's another way that God instructs us to love one another. Well, there's more that you could say about it, but let's go on to verse 10. Now, what was characteristic, or what was one of the things, essentially, that was true of the Thessalonians, according to this verse? What was it that they were in the habit of practicing? Huh? And what was the scope of their practice? How big, wide, short, tall? Well, you know, Greece is kind of a big peninsula, and you come down and you have the Peloponnesus, that's that big suction at the bottom, and there's a little isthmus of land there. In Greek is the Macedonian Peninsula, you have Yugoslavia and Bulgaria and all these other, and it kind of points down into the Mediterranean Sea. And then you have the Peloponnesus at the bottom. Macedonia would be would be the cities of Philippi, would be Thessalonica, would be what are some other cities that are up there? I'm drawing a blank on names. Think of all the different places Paul went. Berea, all these different places he went when he was preaching there. Colossae would be in Asia Minor, but all these different cities and all the different places where he founded churches, Corinth, you know, all these different locations. So what does this tell you about the kind of things the Thessalonians were doing? What does this suggest to you about them as examples? Well, their reputation, remember, no Twitter, no email, no internet, no newspapers, no radio, no TV, no telephones. And yet what was known throughout this whole region? Yeah. That these people in Thessalonica were known as those who truly loved one another. And not only did they love one another, they loved all those other churches in all those other places. How do you think they got that picture, or how do you think that became known? Places like Berea and Corinth and Athens and Thrace and Troas and Thessalonica. How do you think it became known? How did love get transmitted? Did they say in violent times to all the different churches? Probably sent them money. Yeah. They probably sent them support. You know, they probably sent them support. Just like the church of Corinth shows its love for the church in Jerusalem by sending an offering. Because when the Christians in Jerusalem were under persecution, they lost their businesses, they lost their homes, many times they lost their lives, they were kicked out of neighborhoods. So how did they live? Well, other churches, the Gentile churches, sent them offerings. In fact, Paul got himself in trouble. That's when he was bringing an offering back to Jerusalem. That's when he got arrested. So one of the ways was a very practical way of sharing material wealth with these other folks. What are some other ways that love was communicated? Well, probably by sharing of teachers. They probably sent teachers from one place to the other. So notice what he says in verse 10. Are there any commands or any instructions for the Thessalonians themselves in that verse? Yeah, to excel more. What does every football coach want his team to do if they're doing something well? If they're running well or blocking well or tackling well or...
Keep it up, do it better.
Because you can always improve, right? This word again is a word, it means to exhort, to encourage. I appeal to you, I strongly appeal to you, brothers, to do more, to excel even more, to be in abundance, to be in abundance, to be outstanding, to be prominent, to be excel, to be excelling. Now, they are already excelling. So, he wants them to do even more. And then he lists five infinitives. An infinitive is, I like to swim, I like to run, I like to sing, I like to, you know, that's an infinitive. He says, I exhort you to do these five things, okay? One of them is in verse 10, and then the other four are in verse 11. So let's see what it is. The first thing he wants them to do is to excel, to go beyond where they are, to go to a higher degree. Now, this is not unlike what he said in verse 1 of this same passage. Finally then, brethren, we request and exhort you in the Lord that as you receive from us instruction as how to you ought to walk and please God, we, just as you actually do walk, that you excel still more. So he's coming back around, encouraging them again. What are these five? Well, the first one is to excel still more. Let's look at verse 11. There's four in verse 11. Verse 12, I think the last one is in... No, verse 11. And to make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your own hands, just as we commanded you. He lists four infinitives there. What's the first one? Well, before that, there's one. To make it your ambition. Now, when you hear the word ambition, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? When you say someone's ambitious. Okay, they're busy. Yeah. Is that the only thing? Is it good to be ambitious? What's negative? Right.
And
mm-hmm. Yeah. Because we usually associate ambition with selfishness, don't we? You know. But here's Paul saying you should be ambitious, you know. The word comes from two words. It means to love, honor, or to aspire to honor. That's what the word originally is. It's only used three times by Paul. So the first thing he exhorts them to do is to be ambitious. Are we ambitious? What are we ambitious for? Is anyone ambitious here?
I don't know.
Huh?
I'm on the opposite side of that. I think they're
you're not. Okay. Well, okay.
Well, Steve and Dale and everybody, all you guys are ambitious. I'm ambitious. We get the job done. We do things. We get up and we do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a manifestation of what you put a priority on. Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Well, it's not like we wake up every day and we sit on our parents in the house or at the coffee shop. We get out and we do things.
Yeah, yeah. So one way we demonstrate ambition is we are engaged. We're involved in things, right? Well, that's the first infinitive. To have an ambition. Do you know people that don't have ambition? You know? Huh? Okay. So ambition isn't necessarily a bad thing, you know. You heard about the guy who aimed at nothing and he hit it, you know. Yeah. Romans 15:20, Paul says, "And this I aspire to. I aspire to preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named." It's the same word. I have ambition to preach the gospel where Christ was not already named. 2 Corinthians 5:9. "Therefore, we also have as our ambition whether to be at home or absent to be pleasing to God." Proverbs 1:33 says, "Whosoever listens to wisdom will dwell." Well, that's for the second half of this verse. Those two from Corinthians, those are the two quotes about having his ambitions. And here, what is Paul's ambition? Ambition to do what? This is the third infinitive. Yeah, to lead a quiet life. To lead a quiet life. What does it mean to you to lead a quiet life? When you hear that expression, "I'd like to have a quiet life." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do those things seem to be contradictory? I'm ambitious to lead a quiet life. You think that they're opposites, okay? Any other? Do they sound opposite? Let me know when all the stuff's done. To lead a quiet life, this word means to lead a quiet life or to refrain from disturbing activity. Be peaceable, be orderly. What advantage is there in leading a quiet life? Less troubles?
Notice, nobody shooting at them, they're fine, and I guess
What's one of the downsides of always going, 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 going? There's lots of ways you can have quietness. Yeah, there's lots of ways you can have quietness in your life. Proverbs 13, this is the one I started reading before about quietness. Proverbs 1:33 says, "Whoever listens to wisdom will dwell safely and shall be quiet or peaceable from the fear of evil." Whoever listens to wisdom will enjoy peace and quiet. Proverbs 26:20 says, "For lack of wood, the fire goes out, and where there is no whisperer, contention quiets down." That's another kind of quiet, isn't it? That's a quiet of when people aren't gossiping. What's the payoff from that? There's no strife in the... Now, that would never happen in a church, right? But or a family, you know. Acts 11 verse 18 says, "When they heard this, they quieted down and glorified God." And what did they hear? They heard that the Gentiles had put their faith in God. The Jewish believers were complaining about Peter going down and talking to these Gentiles. But when he said they're getting saved, they heard that, they quieted down. Is the church a quiet place, or are we all up in a frenzy? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do at times seem to be up in a tizzy, but. There always should be a measure of peace in a church, you know. And when there's not, again, that's a sign that something's out of whack. So that's the third one, to live a quiet life. What's the fourth one here? These are all things he's urging them to do. They're activities to do. Is there an expression like that? Is it? Now, usually we think about that as how. Once you hear that, what's the first thing? Right, right. But you can look at it in a positive sense, can't you? Which is the way Paul means it here. He's not talking about snooping and sticking your nose into other people's business. He said, mind your own business. In other words, this verse says, attend to your own business. What are some of the advantages that flow from attending to your own business?
You're busy attending your own business, not
okay, so that's one of the advantages. You cut off a whole bunch of problems. Right. So you don't borrow trouble from somebody else or cause trouble to somebody else. You're doing what?
You're helping people deal with the problems that really get addressed. So
In American history, you know what the first coin that was ever minted in America had on it? It was minted by Benjamin Franklin. Guess what it had on it? Mind your own business. It had two things on it. One, I flee. It was a picture of the sun going across the sky. In other words, time is fleeting. So time's passing. And then the flip side of it said, mind your own business. Why mind your own business? What else is true about this little phrase? What is it that's, well, we've been here for, let's see, 40 minutes?
Time slips by.
And? Yeah. Would you say people today are minding their own business? That's where we're going. But don't you really care about how many followers you have? Isn't that important? If we're minding our own business, we avoid other problems. We don't mess up somebody else by sticking our nose in their issues. We're getting done what God's called us to do. We're being productive. We're laboring in the field that God has us in. And generally, if you mind your business, what's going to happen to your business? It's going to get taken care of. And there's a certain... You can have help somebody else, or your prosperity. There's a certain sense in which prosperity is going to grow. Benjamin Franklin was a very practical guy, a very successful guy, and a very productive guy. And one of the reasons was he minded his own business. I mean, he had the first post office, wrote, I mean, was an ambassador to France. I mean, look at all the things he accomplished, and he lived to be in his 80s. And part of the key to that, I think, was minding his own business. And that comes right out of the Scripture. I mean, that idea is right here. And who is Paul telling? Remember, this whole section, remember how we started out. What is the idea of this section? It's our witness to our conduct to the outside world, our public conduct. What does our public conduct look like? That's the idea behind this whole thing. What does our public conduct look like? When people look at us and they look at the church, what are they seeing? Do you ever hear people accuse the church of you're always sticking your nose in other people's business, or they're always, you know, telling people how they should live, that kind of thing? You know, you hear that criticism? Yeah. But we're not talking about... Yeah, we're not talking about not fulfilling the love of Christ by not loving other people, because part of our, what is our business? Isn't that really what it is? You know, our business is helping others and showing the love of God to other people, and also. Your efficiency goes up. Your efficiency goes up. And generally, we do job better. And remember, notice he puts the emphasis on your business. Literally, the word means that thing or person associated with one's own home, one's business, and their own concerns. You know, when we mind our own business, we're paying attention to those things that are our responsibility, aren't we? And what is it to mean to be a good steward? Huh? To be responsible. If we have a certain job, we have a certain responsibility at a school or at a factory or wherever we are, it's our job to take care of what we're asked to do. And we're, you know, again, this thing of minding our own business, staying attuned to what we're supposed to be doing. Paul goes on here now, and he gives us this word to pay attention to. It also can be translated to practice, and In Philippians 4:9, Paul says, "The things that you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you." This idea of continuing at it. Another advantage of attending to your own business is you don't have time to get involved in the wrong things. You ever heard the expression, an idle mind is the devil's workshop? One of the problems, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 13, at the same time they also learn to be idle as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Nature abhors a vacuum, and if we're not engaged in what we're supposed to be doing, we will be engaged in other things that we're not supposed to be doing. You know, and this is the whole Twitter universe, and you know, you think of the hours that are spent on this stuff, and it's just a waste of time, you know. And you can't get that time back. What's the fifth thing here that he stresses in this verse? There's four in this verse. To work with your hands. What are some of the advantages or benefits that come from working with your hands? No benefits? Huh? What?
Keep yourself worn out. Yeah, when I'm worn out, I'm not well behaved. I'm well rested.
When you're worn down, you're well behaved.
I'm well behaved. You can't stay out till midnight in the morning if you're tired. Go like that.
That's right. So when you're working, again, one of the payoffs of work is not just the paycheck, but it's also the keeping you out of the trouble. You know, you avoid your trouble. Is that the only benefit? We're sort of negative. Only we just want to have, what's the positive results of that working with your own hands? Huh?
You get a sense of accomplishment.
All right, how's that work? Can you get an example or something? You ever built anything with your own hands? Ever fixed a car with your own hands? Ever planted a garden with your own hands? Ever planted a garden with your own hands? No? Well, then fixed a car. There you go. Okay. How's that work? How do you get a sense of self-worth from doing stuff your own? You do. Huh? There's a satisfaction that comes from realizing your own potential. God made us to realize our own potential. He put us on the earth to demonstrate our powers. Another way of saying it. Why is it satisfying when you use a gift that God gave you? Right? And you are, in one way, justifying your existence on the earth. You're not just a couch potato. You ever think about how unappealing that image is? A couch potato? What good is a couch potato? It just takes up space, right? You know. Why are so many people dissatisfied with life?
Self-worth, they probably wouldn't need that. So, you know, that's not every case.
So there's a payoff from doing things, isn't there? There's a self concept that comes out of that. What are we telling kids today in school? What's our whole thing about telling kids, you know? The whole thing. What are they constantly telling kids, you know? Even if you don't win a race, even if you don't do anything. Huh? It's way more fun to win. And again, what's the payoff from winning? Why? Right. Yeah. Which is important because, yeah. So kids and adults need to exercise their powers. They need to have opportunities to exercise their powers. They need to have opportunities to achieve things, which means they have to be presented with challenges, and we have to be presented with tasks to do. Okay, little Johnny, there's the toy box. All your toys are all over the floor. Pick up your toys. Big deal. Why? We got to start somewhere. And I heard a Navy SEAL say this the other day. He was being interviewed by Charlie Rose. One of the first things he learned, make your bed. One of the first keys to success in life is make your bed every day. Don't leave the house without your bed. We won't ask if anybody leaves their bed, not made, but he said that was one of the keys to his success. Because when you make your bed, you leave the house, that's one thing you accomplished. You were able to do that.
Well, it's such a pattern of being normal by just doing the tasks instead of. Otherwise, the program would be lazy. Pretty soon, it's everything. You're fighting about everything.
Because if I don't make my bed, and if I go to work, then... See, God built us to be orderly beings. He built us to bring order to chaos, out of chaos. He's not, no. Yeah. And look what results from. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And if you're prepared, yeah, it's true. It's true, and there are a lot of freaked out people today. And if you're not you're not organized, what happens when you have a crisis?
You run, hide, and call help.
Yeah, so God, you know, He gave us two hands to work with. He gave us minds. He gave us bodies. He gave us ways to be in, to act out these things in the world. And we didn't even talk about what does it say to the people out there who don't know Christ when we work with our own hands. I stole that from somebody else, but But it was so good, I thought I got to use that. But the thing is, when you're working with your head, you're usually doing something physical, you know, and you're usually building something or doing something, you know, even if it's checking papers or whatever it is. But you're leaving behind you some order and some organ. Yeah. So you know what that means, what you just said. It means we have to be out doing stuff. You don't want to get hoisted on your own petard. That's what, you know, that's what happens sometimes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it is working. They are noticing. They're watching. Yeah. And for Paul was a living example of this, because what did Paul do when he became a Christian? What did he continue to do even after he was going around spreading the gospel? He made tents. He knew how to make tents, and he made tents. And so there's a whole argument. We talked about this before when we were looking at 1 Timothy about should you pay your pastor, or should your pastor work as a carpenter and then preach on the Sundays? You know, we went through all of that. We talked about that. And there's a whole argument, a whole school of thought in the church. Plymouth Brethren, for instance, or there are churches like that where they have no ordained clergy. You know, they don't have a pastor who just studies the word, prepares lessons. Everybody works. Everybody has a day job, you know. And there's a whole school of thought that says that's the way it should be. They call them tent-making ministries, you know. And there were times when Paul did that. There were other times when he didn't do that, when he was supported by the church. So, but this, it is a witness to other people. It is a witness to other people outside. And notice he closes out verse 11 by saying, "This is how we commanded you." Okay, we got a couple of minutes left here. Notice what he says in verse 12. And what else does he want them to do? In verse 12. It's the end result. What's going to be the end result? So that. Yeah. See, all these things feed together. All these the infinitives, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, they all feed together to a picture. And the picture of someone who is behaving properly. Well, what does it mean to behave properly? This word means decently, becomingly. In Romans 13, Paul uses it and says, "Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity or sensuality, not in strife and jealousy." In 1 Corinthians 14, he uses it again. In fact, he's the only one who uses it in the New Testament when he says, for 1 Corinthians 14:40, "But all things must be done properly and in an orderly manner." Okay, one of the ways we see that is that people stay in bounds. If you're behaving properly on the roadway, what are you usually doing? Because if they see a Christian do that, yeah. So that's like saying it doesn't make any difference if you believe in God or not. Yeah. That's the problem with not doing that. Behaving properly also too, it gives an example to. All the other gives an example to the people that are in church as well. Notice you're behaving properly here towards who? Outsiders. And how are they the outsiders?
Because
What are they outside of? They're outside of the church? Outside the body of Christ? You know? Remember again, where is he telling this to what people? They're living in the city of Thessalonica. Remember what Thessalonica was like? Idolatry, corruption, the Las Vegas. So how are they going to look different in that kind of a context? If they behave properly, then they'll stand out. But if they're doing everything everybody else is doing, there's no distinction. There's no light. And then he closes that out, and he focuses on the last part of that little phrase. Why else work with your own hands? Why else make it your ambition to lead a quiet life? Why else practice these things? Why else love the brethren? What else will result? End of verse 12. Okay, how will it be that there won't be any need? How's that possible? You're taking care of business. If you're taking care of business, there's going to be enough to supply whatever needs. If you're taking care of business, looking out for one another, is there going to be any needy in your midst? Anybody who doesn't have food for that day? Probably not, because we're going to know about it. You know, we're going to take care of it. Is there going to be strife? No, there won't be any need. If there won't be any need in your midst. One of the things that characterized the people of Israel when they were wandering through the wilderness was what? Millions of people wandered through the wilderness. Huh? Well, they whined a lot, but in reality,
they were taken care of.
So again, one of the signs of a healthy church is if there's this awareness of this concern for the needs of others in the church. And if we know of a need, we try to address it. You know, and that's, again, that's a witness to the outside. It's a witness to the community. We had an example of this, 2 weeks ago? Kids over in Vinton needed shoes. And what did the church do? Got shoes for kids in Vinton. Keystone, I'm sorry. I thought it was Vinton. So that's how this principle works. But again, we have to be taking care of business, focusing on the things that we're supposed to focus on. And so now it closes out these first two sections. And so then next time we meet, we'll get into this thing about end times. And we'll probably start with dispensationalism. And what is dispensationalism? Is that dispensationalism a word that's new to you? Have you ever heard that word before? You have? Okay. Because that's one of the things we need to talk about. But we'll talk about amillennialism, postmillennialism, and premillennialism, and we'll get into all this big, because this will be a big end-time prophecy discussion next time we meet. All right, let's pray.